My castaway this week is an entertainer. Now 70 years old, he's been in the business for more than 50 years. His faultless delivery and astonishing memory for lines and jokes won him top billing at an early age, and he went on through shows like The Golden Shot, Bob's Full House and Celebrity Squares to become one of this country's most ubiquitous and familiar celebrities. But the star with the self-confident charm, smarmy some call him, is the product of a difficult upbringing. His mother didn't speak to him for 20 years after he married. "I think, therefore, I invented a facade," he says. He is Bob Monkhouse. Will the real Bob Monkhouse stand up, please? I suppose it's what you've been doing all your life, stand up.
Well, yes, I think because I wasn't much of a fellow when I was young, being yourself made large, which a comedian, I think, ought to be, was not particularly impressive. But because I had facile tongue and I was fairly articulate, I was employed immediately by television.
And a perky mind, you said.
Yeah, a perky mind.
But describe it to me, what happens? Because, of course, we know you prepare very well. You're very diligent, very conscientious. You do a lot of homework. You can construct an act, you know, the scaffolding of the gags, yes, and the lines. But you have to capture that magic out there. And if you don't capture that, it's flat, isn't it?
That's right. But then there are lots of ways of changing your grip on your opponent, if that's the way you view your audience. Or some use the analogy of riding a horse to get that audience correctly paced so that you don't exhaust them too early. Try not to use your A material too soon. You save that for later. And in those first 3 or 4 minutes, you find what the audience is like.
But you're working all of the time. I mean, you're watching yourself, watching them.
Oh, right? Yes.
Working out what it is they like, what it is they're going for.
Yes.
And when, what's the feeling? When, is it a delicious moment when you suddenly you've got them? How does it happen?
They're usually there now. The only dates I hate to play, I love dates where my name is up outside, because then the people know who they're going to see, and they paid for a ticket to see you because they want to see you. So you've won the battle. But when you're booked as a surprise cabaret for 250 butcher's apprentices, and they've all been betting all evening that they're going to see Simply Red, you have got an Everest to climb.
Mm.
Flop sweat is cold. You feel it running down your back, but it's icy. And your suit gets too big for you. You feel as if you're rattling around in your suit. You feel as if you are shrinking as a person. And the one thing that I always tell young comedians that I've discovered is you must slow down when that happens. You can't. If you start chattering fast, the situation worsens.
But just tell me something. I get the impression, reading about you, that you prefer appearing live in a club to being on the television.
More vastly.
And when people see you do that, as I understand it, they come up to you afterwards and say, "We never liked you on the telly, but we like you now."
They used to say that all the time. Now they don't seem to mind me. I think I've battered down their resistance a bit. Well, at least they don't say it to me as often as they used to.
I just wonder if we don't get the facade that I mentioned at the beginning on the television, whereas the real you is out there in the clubs.
Here's my tiny theory, for what it's worth. Television has this subtle way of changing certain elements in what you are, your personality, and it will emphasize some things perhaps which are unsavory instead of those elements which are attractive. And quite often, we all know it puts weight on people. Quite skinny people can appear normally proportioned on television, and fat ladies look enormous. Men, I think, if they attempt to be more friendly and more charming, if you like, than is normal, then it will come over as almost offensively oily or obsequious.
You're talking about yourself.
Mm, and I think that has happened to me. My parents brought me out to be very polite.
Your whole problem is you're too polite and too nice.
That's my way of putting it.
Tell me about your first record.
It's Sinatra. He is the voice of the century. He's the voice of the populist voice of my entire life, Sinatra. I worked with him only once when he came over to do the Showband show in the early 50s. And I went round with Cyril Stapleton, the band leader, the Showband leader, and the producer, John Brough, and Johnny Stewart, to present him with the continuity script that I'd written. And he kept us waiting for a couple of hours in an anteroom to the suite he had in the London Hotel. And so the other two left. They decided that it was my job to go through the script with him. And after about another half an hour, I badly needed the lavatory, so I started experimenting with doors, and I opened a door, and it obviously was a bathroom, and I tiptoed across to use the loo, and a cake of soap hit me on the head. So I rushed out, not attempting to explain myself, and opened the wrong door again, and I recognized the young lady who was in the double bed, and Sinatra then appeared in the doorway behind me and socked me Well, as I was turning, he obviously made for my face, but I turned away, and he got me in the side of the jaw and the neck. And when he came on the show, he was courtesy itself, enormously professional, very charming, did the script, never spoke to me. And he left, and his assistant pressed a little box into my hand and said, "That's Frank's apology." And it was a gold Rolex.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather since my gal and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather just can't get my poor old self together. I'm weary all the time, every time. So weary all of the time.
Frank Sinatra and Stormy Weather, and you couldn't be cast away without him. You worked with him, you worked with them all, it seems to me. Dean Martin, Lenny Bruce, Jack Benny, Tommy Cooper, Bing Crosby. Didn't you write a script for Crosby that you delivered completely pie-eyed?
Yes, he was pie-eyed. I've never seen anything like it in my life. We met him at the Criterion for lunch. Ronnie Waldman was then the head of Variety, and a number of other people were there. And he was asking if he'd like something to drink, and he said, "I'll have a bourbon." And Ronnie Waldman said, "Shall we make it a large one?" He said, "No, just a regular bottle." Well, bourbon was hard to get in the early 50s, but they managed to find a bottle of some kind of bourbon, old Grandad or something, and throughout the meal, without eating much of his chicken Maryland, Bing just swigged the bottle until it was empty, and his eyes were rolling in his head, and he was completely stoicious. He was, and we had great difficulty getting him under the arms and out into a snowy London, and his feet skidding around on the icy pavement. And so we said, "We can't possibly do the program." And his musical director, John Scott Trotter, said, "He'll be all right." He said, "But what are you talking about? He won't be all right. He'll be all right." And he was useless in the wings behind that curtain that used to be. And the stage was beyond us, and the orchestra on one side, and the studio audience on the other. And then his bell note played, just the first note of his signature tune, which was "When the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day." Bong! And he straightened. And it wasn't an illusion, just his eyes focused, and his backbone straightened, and he just, as his foot hit the stage, he was sober.
Do you ever drink before you go? You're a malt whiskey man, aren't you?
Yes, I love malt whiskey. I always have a large slug before I go on stage, if I'm going to work for over an hour. And around about 45 minutes in, I get a surge of energy, which I may be kidding myself, but I think I probably burned up that alcohol, turned it into sugar, and it's given me another forward plunge.
But what you do, you have a gag for every circumstance, don't you? I mean, in fact, you've done whole programs about it, like Gag Tag. Somebody, yeah. I mean, if I say New Year to you, you can give me a gag.
Yes. I find I've got to cut down my New Year's Eve drinking because I wake up with a pitted complexion from my face having been laying in a bowl of peanuts all night.
Now, when you do that, your eyes sort of go off to the right slightly. So is it a photographic memory? Are you looking at the page somewhere?
I'm weaving words together. I was trying to think through to, as soon as you said that, I was trying to think of where you would drink, and I saw immediately a bowl of peanuts. So I thought, that's what I do. What did I do with that? The idea for the pictorial joke.
But you do write these jokes down, don't you? In I understand, different coloured inks.
Yes.
We know you do, because, of course, the books were stolen. Right?
When my books were stolen, and they're safely back with me now, thank heavens, they were, in fact, colour-coded.
Coded for what?
Partly for memory, because I can remember what's in red ink, blue ink, green ink, brown ink, whatever it is. If it's a bit naughty, the joke's a bit naughty, it's in brown. If the joke is something that I've derived from somebody else's idea, it's always in green. If it's an incomplete thought, it's in black, and needs improvement and needs to work on it.
If you can call them up so easily, which you obviously can, why was there such a fuss when you lost the books?
Well, in the books, there weren't just jokes. You can buy a joke book in a shop. It was material, the very warp and weft of what I do for a living. It was cartoons, drawings of props, whole scenes of sketches and plays, ideas for plays and plots, material that I intend to work on for the next 10 years.
So when you lost it, it was terrible?
It was awful, because I hadn't bothered to actually connect it all to memory or to computer. The books were always with me.
Second record.
When I was a teenager, and I had a wonderful romantic time with a number of very, very short-sighted women, and every time I seemed to be enjoying Congress, on the radio there was Vaughan Monroe's hit record of Racing with the Moon. It was his signature tune. He'd written it himself. And Vaughan Monroe was a band leader who actually wanted to be an operatic singer, I believe, at one time. He made one movie as a cowboy, and he was exactly the way his voice sounded, a muscular-looking man. He sounds like a weightlifter who's decided to sing. And this particular melody, it's a lovely melody, and it's something that brings up so many memories of my teen years in my mind, many of them utterly delicious and experimental.
Racing with the moon, high up in the midnight blue, it's lost from view, gazing at the stars, dreaming of the love we knew, and then like the moon,
singing his theme tune, Racing with the Moon. Memories of 1,000, if not more, romantic entanglements. It was your marriage as a result of one of those romantic entanglements at the age of 21 that alienated you from your family. Is it true your mother came to the wedding eventually but in black?
Yes. I still have photographs of her stern-faced in that black outfit that she bought especially for it, I think.
But why?
I never really understood myself until I had a kind of epiphany, I suppose, right in the middle of talking to Dr. Anthony Clare in a studio not unlike this. And I suppose I became rather emotional. I don't know, that studio is dark, and I wasn't facing the control panel. I'd even forgotten I was on the radio. And he asked me, did I think my mother hated me? And He guided me into realizing that my mother's love for me was much greater than she could handle. And I had never seen it that way. In all those years, I hadn't
thought... Because she'd been so undemonstrative towards you.
Yes. She was brought up, I suppose, not to show her feelings, and therefore didn't expect her children to show their feelings. And she was not a woman who was tactile in any way. I can remember only one occasion, once I left infancy behind, when she actually embraced me, and that was out of fear of doodle bugs, buzz bombs falling.
What about your father in all of this? He was pretty bleak too, by the sound of it.
Yes, Dad was a prematurely bald accountant of somewhat parsimonious disposition, who was, I think, fairly well dominated by my mother. He seemed to be quite frightened of her at times. And certainly, I do believe he came to see me once. I did a show at Streatham Hill Theatre, and I'm sure as I looked out the window I saw my father leaving in the audience.
But other than that, you don't know that either of them ever saw you?
No. Dad died when he was 64 in 1957, and although I had my own television series by that time and was off to the races, as it were, as a performer, I've no idea whether he was either pleased or displeased by that. People have written to me subsequent to that Anthony Clare programme, who knew my mother in the latter part of her life, and they tell me in the letters, whether they're just being kind or not, I just don't know, but they said that she was very proud of me.
And that helps, obviously. I mean,
that was a great consolation for me, yes. That's something I want to believe, those letters.
But the other thing that strikes me reading about all of this, because you've written about it, is that in the midst of all this awful lovelessness, is what it sounds like, you never really got low. You were never brought down by it. You always kept your pecker sunny side up, Bob.
No. You know. I don't know whether that's an indication of shallowness of character, or whether it's just that my equanimity is such a powerful thing within me that there is no dark side. I don't suffer from any kind of melancholia. I'm never bored, and I don't get depressed.
Tell me about your third record.
No, I suppose arising out of my lack of melancholia is my fascination with things that are melancholy. It's as if I'm reaching for melancholy music in an effort to understand its inspiration. And when Maurice Ravel, at a very young age, I think in his 20s, wrote his Pavane for a Dead Princess, he had no particular princess in mind, apparently, although the reference to an enfant seems to suggest infant or a Spanish princess. But the melody line, which he wrote for piano, it wasn't orchestrated by him until 10 years later, but nevertheless, and when he did come to orchestrate it, he used every part of the orchestra so elliptically, so smoothly, that it seems to suggest a kind of gentle, beautiful misery, and I find that enthralling.
Of Ravel's Pavane for a Dead Princess, played by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Jan Pascal Tortelier. And that's Bob Mankas hankering after a bit of misery.
But it is so beautiful. Lovelier than that music doesn't get.
What did your parents say when you told them that you wanted to become a comedian?
Don't ever remember that happening, to tell you the truth.
But your mother had paraded you in front of friends, hadn't she?
My mother was a good artist. She was a good painter. She was a watercolourist, really, and not a bad sculptress either. And she had always encouraged me to draw. So she really saw my future as being in cartooning, or doing a cartoon strip for the newspapers. I drew a lot for comics, you know, the children's weeklies, when I was in my teens. And
make money?
Oh, yes. I always had an eye on making a few bob. So from the age of, I think my first publication was in Mickey Mouse Weekly when I was 12. And I got, I think, a guinea for that. Then I sold some jokes at the stage door of the Lewisham Hippodrome and the Penge Empire to some comedians. I just went there on my bike. I'd written the jokes. I'd typed them out on a very old Imperial, which I'd bought for £11. and took my jokes there, and I managed to sell a few.
Is that where you met Max Miller?
Yes.
He bought some jokes from you, did he?
His dresser actually took them into him and came back and gave me... I used to say, well, he gave me folding money, but you'd have to put a hinge in a half crown for it to have been that. Max was notoriously stingy. But he was very generous with advice, and he said one line I've never forgotten. He had me sat in the back of his Rolls-Royce Max 1 during a charity concert, and he gave me more or less a masterclass in timing and audacity. And he had one lovely line. I don't know whether he originated it. I imagine he did. He said, you know, comedy is the one job you can do badly and no one will laugh at you. Oh, great line.
And Arthur Askey gave you a few tips as well, didn't he?
Arthur was my friend. I cuddled my radio in bed. He used to suck the flex. I loved it so. Which I'm surprised I'm still alive to tell the tale. So when Dennis Goodwin, my late writing partner, and I, in 1949, were invited to write a radio series called Calling All Forces, hosted by Ted Ray, Arthur Askey was the first guest ever on that. Arthur had several wonderful little tricks that I know every time I want to pull applause from an audience, and I don't think they're going to applaud if I just give them straight delivery, I do a little check step backwards. Arthur used to do the line and then step back, just move back from the microphone, clapping his hands at the same time. And the very sound of one clap inspired more clapping, and so the audience would, almost as if psychologically he was leaving. So
he's going to take a little bow, a little skip back.
Yes, and sometimes if he wanted to extend a laugh, he would hold his sides and laugh like that silly-looking sailor outside the Blackpool Fun Fair who rolls around like that. And
See, I'm doing it now.
I often do that.
Tell me about your next record, number four.
Oh, Samuel Barber, the American composer, was about 24 when he wrote his Adagio for Strings, Opus 11. And again, it's a melody that I find entrancingly sad but uplifting.
The opening of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, Opus 11, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Geoffrey Simon. What was your first big break in television, Bob? How did it come about?
Well, I started in television in 1947 up at Alexandra Palace doing a show for Duncan Wood, which I don't think even he watched. And then, after that, nothing seemed to happen for me in television. I was doing guest appearances on things, but nothing seemed to be moving at that time. And then 1951 or two, I had a wonderful break. I'd been writing radio shows for Richard Murdoch and Kenneth Horne and Sam Costa, a famous comedy team from Much Binding in the Marsh, quite my favourite half hour in comedy ever. And Richard Murdoch was a man of extraordinary charm and kindness. He was very encouraging to me, but I used to say, gosh, I wish you'd come and see me perform. So he came out to see me at the Nuffield Centre, which was the famous centre in London for forces, guys and girls in uniform, to go. And he's enthused. He said, you've got to get that. You've got to see you do that on television. People will be amazed at the speed and the timing. He just encouraged me so much. And then one day, he said, I'm booked to compere a show called Garrison Theatre from Litchfield for an army camp by a very nice man called Barry Edgar. And if I went ill about 2 days before we had to do it and recommended you to replace me, would you be ready? And I said, that's the most incredibly generous thing I've ever heard. And he said, no, nonsense. Nonsense.
And he did it.
And that's exactly what he did.
And were you any good?
I was sensational. I was better than good. I got all this stuff in my head, and I'd done my 3 years in the RAF, so my head was, I knew the Forces attitude, and my Forces audience was just a darling situation for me. And Alma Cogan was on the show, and I remember Barry Edgar, after the rehearsal, said, Alma, you've got to cut a number. Everyone's got to cut a number to make room for this boy.
More music.
I'll need to laugh on my desert island, and there are certain things that never fail to make me laugh, never, ever, ever let me down. And one of those particular things is Jonathan and Darlene Edwards' recordings. It takes a singer of extraordinary skill to sing not only off the beat, but with just off the note. It is hysterical to me. It makes me laugh every time I hear it, and I'll laugh again now.
Jonathan and Darlene Edwards performing their inimitable version of Ain't She Sweet. You had a son, Bob, in 1952, Gary, who was born with cerebral palsy. He was very disabled, wasn't he?
Yes, Gary was grossly handicapped.
What was he like as a character?
Oh, he's still with me every day. He died 5 years ago. I can never get through a day without thinking of him and being inspired by him too. He was an astonishing fellow. I mean, he could be Hitler on wheels sometimes, but he had a knockdown smile. He was very handsome. He couldn't hear and he couldn't speak, and he couldn't stand or sit unaided. He had to have a strap around him to stay in his chair, and he couldn't use his hands. They had to be tied down, and he had to wear gloves at all times because otherwise the fingernails would have torn at his palms. But he could control his right leg. His left leg he used as kind of paperweight, but he could hold a pen between the big toe and the next toe of his right foot and draw. And he had a great sense of humour.
Did you help put him along? He was born at the time when your career was taking off, wasn't he?
Yes. And
how involved were you with the practical day-to-day?
Oh, enormously involved. In fact, I couldn't not be with Gary for too long. He needed to see me, and I needed to see him. So I couldn't accept engagements abroad. So I couldn't. Several people have suggested I might have had a career in the United States, and that did crop up. But I couldn't leave this country. Well, not while Gary needed to see me regularly. And I found my need to see him became greater with the passing of the years, because he had a purity about him, an innocence about him, which he never lost. Most of us lose it.
It's often said that comics or writers use the pain in their lives. Did you use him? Did you use Gary in your work?
Whenever anything has upset me greatly, I mean, given me nightmares or has troubled me. I've usually wrapped it in a joke. I've usually turned it into a gag. There's been a tragedy, perhaps, in the press that's caused me to have a tear. Then I will make a joke out of it.
You made a joke about your mother, didn't you? I mean, a lot of your jokes have become, my mother never loved me.
I've done 1,000 jokes about my mother never loved me, my mother never wanted me. And there was one gag I did on sort of Live from the Palladium or something, which got a hoot, a crack of laughter, because if humour is... If, other than blue humour, humour that is based upon tragedy is particularly funny to an audience. They reserve their biggest laughs for that which is sounds kind of the pornography of death. And I had a gag about my mother when I was a little baby. I hate to say this, but she tried to kill me when I was a baby. You may be shocked at that. I wouldn't be surprised. She denied having tried to kill me. She told the police she thought the plastic bag would keep me fresh. Now, that is a cracking gag. That will laugh. Is enormous, and I used to do that gag regularly.
It's dangerous because it's on the edge of bad taste. Well, it is bad taste, isn't it?
It's in terrible taste, but the reason I wrote the joke and did it was because I had read of a tragedy in the press and thought, I can't stand this, the way it was described in the paper. It haunted me. So I wrote the joke and got rid of it.
But not Gary.
I could never make jokes about cerebral palsy.
Next piece of music.
Part of the Adagietto from Mahler's Symphony No. 5. This never ceases to astonish me, no matter how prepared I am for the passage in which the music suddenly rises as if to the heavens. It still is a surging nutrient for my spirit. It's like vitamins for the soul.
Of the Adagietto from Mahler's Symphony No. 5, performed by the Orchestra of the Academy of St. Cecilia in Rome, directed by Franco Manino. You've been, whatever you say, Bob, a huge success. You know, you've won all the awards there are, and you've made and are still making, I think, a very good living. You've got a happy second marriage, and you've got a lovely home, and you've got grandchildren, and you've got it all. But you presumably needed all of that support, because you have taken, during the course of your career, a hell of a lot of flack, haven't you? And we've touched on some of it. You know, I said to Smarmy in the beginning, Ollie Agnes, instance. Why do you think there's been so much? Why have you succeeded in getting up people's noses so much?
I've never figured it out. In all this time, I've never managed to work out quite what it is that arouses such venom in the press. And it seems to be extraordinary, because I don't get that from members of the public who seem to watch what I do, and either they find me funny or they don't. If they laugh, then to a certain extent they are committed to tolerating me, at least.
But you said earlier on that things changed rather when you showed your vulnerability, when you revealed, you know, your background and the difficulties of your mother and son. I wonder if that's it, that you didn't seem to be vulnerable before. You just seemed to be ever sunny, ever smiling, impregnable.
That could be part of the reason, I suppose, and I'm sure that is a contributory factor to people liking me a bit better if they know that I'm not assuming the stance of someone who thinks he's... the man who thinks he's it, as Steve Coogan calls his show. But I still don't understand why I excite such extraordinary dislike among pretty good writers. I mean, I've read some marvellously written stuff attacking me in the press. One writer actually wrote quite recently, I was really disappointed with Bob Monkhouse's home, which was a rather tasteful affair. I was hoping it would be as tacky and vile as possible.
So it's all hurt?
Yes, I wish I could say it. I used to say, oh, no, I'm all scar tissue now, it doesn't hurt at all, but it does hurt. I mean,
when you're 70, it goes on hurting, does it?
Well, nobody sets out to be disliked.
Tell me about your sixth record.
I have a very happy marriage with Jackie, second marriage, 25 years married. But I wrote in the first of my two autobiography books that the problem with a very happy marriage is it can't have a happy ending. Well, that made one or two people write me letters saying, which would you rather have, a happy ending or a happy marriage? One guy wrote and said that his wife had just recently died, and that what I had written had made him realize that what he had were wonderful memories.
And evening, when the kettle's on for tea, an old familiar feeling settles over me, and it's your face I see, and I believe that you are there. In the garden, when I stop to touch a rose and feel the petals soft and sweet against my nose, I smile and I suppose that somehow maybe you are there. When I'm dreaming and I find myself awake without a warning, and I rub my eyes and fantasize, and all at once I realize it's morning, and my fantasy is fading like a distant star at dawn. My dearest dream is gone. I often think there's just one thing to do: pretend the dream is true and tell myself that you are there.
Michael Feinstein, and You Are There. It's casting away time, Bob. Does that fill you with dread?
I quite enjoy my own company.
What about Bob's Desert Island? Is it in the book? Is it in the joke book? Desert Island, Bob, for Bob.
I think one of the first jokes I ever had was about a desert island. It was Robinson Crusoe, who had all his work done by Friday. therefore had his weekends free. I guess that's the approach. I think I altered that. I said, Robinson Crusoe, he'd be alone on a desert island for 20 years, and he never went to work on Friday, which is a rather ruder version of the same joke.
It would, though, a desert island, be enforced retirement. You know, no audience, no work, you know, no diligently going about your business, nothing to prepare for. You just couldn't cope with that, could you?
I have a very fertile imagination, and I can live in my mind quite happily for quite some considerable length of time.
But real retirement for real is something you'll never do, is it?
No, I don't have to, do I?
You'll die standing up.
I hope that never happens again. But yes, I think the way Dear Tommy Cooper went and Kenneth Horne was wonderful. Getting a laugh, that's the last sound they heard, and I think that's rather miraculous.
Last record.
Well, I've always felt a bit a bit funny about people who come on Desert Island Discs and choose their own records. But there's a lovely song called You Have Cast Your Shadow on the Sea, a most unusual little song, written by Rodgers and Hart for their production of The Boys from Syracuse back in the 30s. And we revived that in 1963 and did it at Drury Lane. And I played Antipholus of Syracuse or Antipholus of Ephesus. I can't remember which Antipholus I was. Dennis Quilly was my twin. And it was a lovely, lovely experience.
Let the winds of the seven seas blow my good ship where they please. I can never sail away from you. Though my bark like a shell is hurled to the edge of this flat old world, you'll be with me till the journey's through, until I return to you. You have cast your shadow on the sea, on both the sea. Not a shadow dancing in the sun that fades when day is done. All I sail and reach the ends of the world, your hand will reach my heart. Cast your shadow on the sea, you'll be with me.
My castaway, aged 35 at the time, Bob Monkhouse, singing You Have Cast Your Shadow on the Sea from Rodgers and Hart, The Boys from Syracuse. If you could only take one of those eight records, Bob, which one would you take?
Oh, I think it would have to be the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber.
What about your book?
That would be the complete works of Lewis Carroll.
What about if you could only have one bit of Lewis Carroll?
Well, Hunting of the Snark, I suppose, is my favourite piece of work by Lewis Carroll. But then again, I couldn't do without the characters in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. No, it would be, can I please have the complete adventures of Alice?
What about your luxury?
I think I've given it a lot of thought. I finally concluded that what I'd like to have is a clarinet. I always loved Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw, and I haven't got either of their records in my collection of eight for the Desert Island, but I think I could teach myself to play the... It's the only instrument I've ever managed to conquer was a recorder. And I think I'd like to teach myself to play. I wouldn't disturb anyone practicing and playing badly. I would eventually, I think, satisfy myself. And furthermore, I could go snorkeling and use it for that purpose.
Bob Monkhouse, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue.